Chapter 4. How the Brigadier Slew the Fox. Left bracket, right bracket. This story, already published in the Green Flag, is included here, so that all of the Brigadier Gerard stories may appear together. In all the great hosts of France, there was only one officer toward whom the English of Wellington's army retained a deep, steady, and unchangeable hatred. There were plunderers among the French, and men of violence, gamblers, duelists, and rowers. All these could be forgiven, for others of their kidney were to be found among the ranks of the English. But one officer of Massena's force had committed a crime which was unspeakable, unheard of, abominable, only to be alluded to with curses late in the evening, when a second bottle had loosened the tongues of men. The news of it was carried back to England, and country gentlemen who knew little of the details of the war grew crimson with passion when they heard of it, and yeomen of the shires raised freckled fists to heaven and swore. And yet who should be the doer of this dreadful deed but our friend the Brigadier, Etienne Gerard, of the Hussars of Conflans, gay riding, plume tossing, debonair, the darling of the ladies, and of the 6 brigades of light cavalry. But the strange part of it is that this gallant gentleman did this hateful thing, and made himself the most unpopular man in the peninsula, without ever knowing that he had done a crime for which there is hardly a name amid all the resources of our language. He died of old age, and never once in that imperturbable self-confidence which adorned or disfigured his character knew that so many thousand Englishmen would gladly have hanged him with their own hands. On the contrary, he numbered this adventure among those other exploits which he has given to the world, and many a time he chuckled and hugged himself as he narrated it to the eager circle who gathered round him in that humble café where, between his dinner and his dominoes, he would tell, amid tears and laughter, of that inconceivable Napoleonic past when France, like an angel of wrath, rose up, splendid and terrible, before a cowering continent. Let us listen to him as he tells the story in his own way, and from his own point of view. You must know, my friends, said he, that it was toward the end of the year 1810, that I and Massena and the others pushed Wellington backward until we had hoped to drive him and his army into the Tagus. But when we were still 25 miles from Lisbon, we found that we were betrayed, for what had this Englishman done but built an enormous line of works and forts at a place called Torres Vedras, so that even we were unable to get through them. They lay across the whole peninsula, and our army was so far from home that we did not dare to risk a reverse, and we had already learned at Busaco that it was no child's play to fight against these people. What could we do, then, but sit down in front of these lines and blockade them to the best of our power? There we remained for 6 months, amid such anxieties, that Massena said afterward that he had not one hair which was not white upon his body. For my own part, I did not worry much about our situation, but I looked after our horses, who were in much need of rest and green fodder. For the rest, we drank the wine of the country, and passed the time as best we might. There was a lady at Santorum, but my lips are sealed. It is the part of a gallant man to say nothing, though he may indicate that he could say a great deal. One day Massena sent for me, and I found him in his tent with a great plan pinned upon the table. He looked at me in silence with that single piercing eye of his, and I felt by his expression that the matter was serious. He was nervous and ill at ease, but my bearing seemed to reassure him. It is good to be in contact with brave men. Colonel Etienne Gerard, said he, I have always heard that you are a very gallant and enterprising officer. It was not for me to confirm such a report, and yet it would be folly to deny it, so I clinked my spurs together and saluted. You are also an excellent rider. I admitted it. And the best swordsman in the 6 brigades of light cavalry. Massena was famous for the accuracy of his information. Now, said he, if you will look at this plan, you will have no difficulty in understanding what it is that I wish you to do. These are the lines of Torres Vedras. You will perceive that they cover a vast space, and you will realize that the English can only hold a position here and there. Once through the lines, you have 25 miles of open country which lie between them and Lisbon. It is very important to me to learn how Wellington's troops are distributed throughout that space, and it is my wish that you should go and ascertain. His words turned me cold. Sir, said I, it is impossible that a colonel of light cavalry should condescend to act as a spy. He laughed and clapped me on the shoulder. You would not be a hussar if you were not a hothead, said he. If you will listen, you will understand that I have not asked you to act as a spy. What do you think of that horse? He had conducted me to the opening of his tent, and there was a chasseur who led up and down a most admirable creature. He was a dapple gray, not very tall, a little over 15 hands perhaps, but with the short head and splendid arch of the neck which comes with the Arab blood. His shoulders and haunches were so muscular, and yet his legs so fine, that it thrilled me with joy, just to gaze upon him. A fine horse or a beautiful woman, I cannot look at them unmoved, even now when 70 winters have chilled my blood. You can think how it was in the year 10. This, said Massena, is Voltigeur, the swiftest horse in our army. What I desire is that you should start tonight, ride round the lines upon the flank, make your way across the enemy's rear, and return upon the other flank, bringing me news of his disposition. You will wear a uniform, and will, therefore, if captured, be safe from the death of a spy. It is probable that you will get through the lines unchallenged, for the posts are very scattered. Once through, in daylight you can outride anything which you meet, and if you keep off the roads you may escape entirely unnoticed. If you have not reported yourself by tomorrow night, I will understand that you are taken, and I will offer them Colonel Petri in exchange. Ah, how my heart swelled with pride and joy as I sprang into the saddle and galloped this grand horse up and down to show the marshal the mastery which I had of him. He was magnificent, we were both magnificent, for Massena clapped his hands and cried out in his delight. It was not I, but he, who said that a gallant beast deserves a gallant rider. Then, when for the third time, with my panache flying, and my dolman streaming behind me, I thundered past him, I saw upon his hard old face that he had no longer any doubt that he had chosen the man for his purpose. I drew my saber, raised the hilt to my lips in salute, and galloped on to my own quarters. Already the news had spread that I had been chosen for a mission, and my little rascals came swarming out of their tents to cheer me. Ah! It brings the tears to my old eyes when I think how proud they were of their colonel. And I was proud of them also. They deserved a dashing leader. The night promised to be a stormy one, which was very much to my liking. It was my desire to keep my departure most secret, for it was evident that if the English heard that I had been detached from the army, they would naturally conclude that something important was about to happen. My horse was taken, therefore, beyond the picket line, as if for watering, and I followed and mounted him there. I had a map, a compass, and a paper of instructions from the marshal, and with these in the bosom of my tunic, and my saber at my side, I set out upon my adventure. A thin rain was falling, and there was no moon, so you may imagine that it was not very cheerful. But my heart was light at the thought of the honor which had been done me, and the glory which awaited me. This exploit should be one more in that brilliant series which was to change my saber into a baton. Ah, how we dreamed, we foolish fellows, young, and drunk with success. Could I have foreseen that night as I rode, the chosen man of 60,000, that I should spend my life planting cabbages on 100 francs a month? Oh, my youth, my hopes, my comrades! But the wheel turns and never stops. Forgive me, my friends, for an old man has his weakness. My route, then, lay across the face of the high ground of Tours Vedras, then over a streamlet, past a farmhouse which had been burned down, and was now only a landmark, then through a forest of young cork oaks, and so to the monastery of San Antonio, which marked the left of the English position. Here I turned south, and rode quietly over the downs, for it was at this point that Massena thought that it would be most easy for me to find my way unobserved through the position. I went very slowly, for it was so dark that I could not see my hand in front of me. In such cases I leave my bridle loose, and let my horse pick its own way. Voltigeur went confidently forward, and I was very content to sit upon his back, and to peer about me, avoiding every light. For 3 hours we advanced in this cautious way, until it seemed to me that I must have left all danger behind me. I then pushed on more briskly, for I wished to be in the rear of the whole army by daybreak. There are many vineyards in these parts which in winter become open plains, and a horseman finds few difficulties in his way. But Massena had underrated the cunning of these English, for it appears that there was not one line of defense but three, and it was the third, which was the most formidable, through which I was at that instant passing. As I rode, elated at my own success, a lantern flashed suddenly before me, and I saw the glint of polished gun barrels, and the gleam of a red coat. "Who goes there?" cried a voice, such a voice. I swerved to the right and rode like a madman, but a dozen squirts of fire came out of the darkness, and the bullets whizzed all round my ears. That was no new sound to me, my friends, though I will not talk like a foolish conscript, and say that I have ever liked it. But at least it had never kept me from thinking clearly, and so I knew that there was nothing for it but to gallop hard, and try my luck elsewhere. I rode round the English picket, and then, as I heard nothing more of them, I concluded rightly that I had at last come through their defenses. For 5 miles I rode south, striking a tinder from time to time to look at my pocket compass. And then in an instant, I feel the pang once more as my memory brings back the moment my horse, without a sob or staggers, fell stone dead beneath me. I had never known it, but one of the bullets from that infernal picket had passed through his body. The gallant creature had never winced nor weakened, but had gone while life was in him. One instant I was secure on the swiftest, most graceful horse in Massena's army. The next he lay upon his side, worth only the price of his hide, and I stood there that most helpless, most ungainly of creatures, a dismounted hussar. What could I do with my boots, my spurs, my trailing saber? I was far inside the enemy's lines. How could I hope to get back again? I am not ashamed to say that I, Etienne Gerard, sat upon my dead horse, and sank my face in my hands in my despair. Already the first streaks were whitening the east. In half an hour it would be light. That I should have won my way past every obstacle, and then at this last instant be left at the mercy of my enemies, my mission ruined, and myself a prisoner, was it not enough to break a soldier's heart? But courage, my friends. We have these moments of weakness, the bravest of us. But I have a spirit like a slip of steel, for the more you bend it, the higher it springs. One spasm of despair, and then a brain of ice and a heart of fire. All was not yet lost. I who had come through so many hazards would come through this one also. I rose from my horse and considered what had best be done. And first of all it was certain that I could not get back. Long before I could pass the lines it would be broad daylight. I must hide myself for the day, and then devote the next night to my escape. I took the saddle, holsters, and bridle from poor Voltigeur, and I concealed them among some bushes, so that no one finding him could know that he was a French horse. Then, leaving him lying there, I wandered on in search of some place where I might be safe for the day. In every direction I could see campfires upon the sides of the hills, and already figures had begun to move around them. I must hide quickly, or I was lost. But where was I to hide? It was a vineyard in which I found myself, the poles of the vine still standing, but the plants gone. There was no cover there. Besides, I should want some food and water before another night had come. I hurried wildly onward through the waning darkness, trusting that chance would be my friend. And I was not disappointed. Chance is a woman, my friends, and as he has her I always upon a gallant hussar. Well then, as I stumbled through the vineyard, something loomed in front of me, and I came upon a great square house with another long, low building upon one side of it. Three roads met there, and it was easy to see that this was the posada, or wine shop. There was no light in the windows, and everything was dark and silent. But, of course, I knew that such comfortable quarters were certainly occupied, and probably by someone of importance. I have learned, however, that the nearer the danger may really be the safer place, and so I was by no means inclined to trust myself away from this shelter. The low building was evidently the stable, and into this I crept, for the door was unlatched. The place was full of bullocks and sheep, gathered there, no doubt, to be out of the clutches of marauders. A ladder led to a loft, and up this, I climbed and concealed myself very snugly among some bales of hay upon the top. This loft had a small open window, and I was able to look down upon the front of the inn, and also upon the road. There I crouched and waited to see what would happen. It was soon evident that I had not been mistaken when I had thought that this might be the quarters of some person of importance. Shortly after daybreak, an English light dragoon arrived with a dispatch, and from then onward the place was in a turmoil, officers continually riding up and away. Always the same name was upon their lips. Stapleton, Sir Stapleton. It was hard for me to lie there with a dry mustache, and watch the great flagons which were brought out by the landlord to these English officers. But it amused me to look at their fresh-colored, clean-shaven, careless faces, and to wonder what they would think if they knew that so celebrated a person was lying so near to them. And then, as I lay and watched, I saw a sight which filled me with surprise. It is incredible the insolence of these English. What do you suppose Millard Wellington had done when he found that Messina had blockaded him and that he could not move his army? I might give you many guesses. You might say that he had raged, that he had despaired, that he had brought his troops together and spoken to them about glory and the fatherland before leading them to one last battle. No, Millard did none of these things. But he sent a fleet ship to England to bring him a number of fox dogs, and he with his officers settled himself down to chase the fox. It is true what I tell you. Behind the lines of Tors Vedras these mad Englishmen made the fox chase 3 days in the week. We had heard of it in the camp, and now I was myself to see that it was true. For, along the road which I have described, there came these very dogs, 30 or 40 of them, white and brown, each with its tail at the same angle, like the bayonets of the old guard. My faith, but it was a pretty sight. And behind and amidst them there rode 3 men with peaked caps and red coats, whom I understood to be the hunters. After them came many horsemen with uniforms of various kinds, stringing along the roads in twos and threes, talking together and laughing. They did not seem to be going above a trot, and it appeared to me that it must indeed be a slow fox which they hoped to catch. However, it was their affair, not mine, and soon they had all passed my window and were out of sight. I waited and I watched, ready for any chance which might offer. Presently an officer, in a blue uniform not unlike that of our flying artillery, came cantering down the road, an elderly, stout man he was, with gray side whiskers. He stopped and began to talk with an orderly officer of dragoons, who waited outside the inn, and it was then that I learned the advantage of the English which had been taught me. I could hear and understand all that was said. "Where is the meat?" said the officer, and I thought that he was hungering for his beefsteak. But the other answered him that it was near Altara, so I saw that it was a place of which he spoke. "You are late, Sir George," said the orderly. "Yes, I had a court-martial. Has Sir Stapleton Cotton gone?" At this moment a window opened, and a handsome young man in a very splendid uniform looked out of it. "Halloa, Murray," said he. "These cursed papers keep me, but I will be at your heels." "Very good, Cotton. I am late already, so I will ride on. You might order my groom to bring round my horse," said the young general at the window to the orderly below, while the other went on down the road. The orderly rode away to some outlying stable, and then in a few minutes there came a smart English groom with a cockade in his hat, leading by the bridle a horse, and, oh, my friends, you have never known the perfection to which a horse can attain until you have seen a first-class English hunter. He was superb. tall, broad, strong, and yet as graceful and agile as a deer. Coal black he was in color, and his neck, and his shoulder, and his quarters, and his fetlocks, how can I describe them all to you? The sun shone upon him, as on polished ebony, and he raised his hoofs in a little playful dance so lightly and prettily, while he tossed his mane and whinnied with impatience. Never have I seen such a mixture of strength and beauty and grace. I had often wondered how the English hussars had managed to ride over the chasseurs of the guards in the affair at Astorga, but I wondered no longer when I saw the English horses. There was a ring for fastening bridles at the door of the inn, and the groom tied the horse there while he entered the house. In an instant I had seen the chance which fate had brought to me. Were I in that saddle I should be better off than when I started. Even Voltigeur could not compare with this magnificent creature. To think is to act with me. In one instant I was down the ladder, and at the door of the stable. The next I was out and the bridle was in my hand. I bounded into the saddle. Somebody, the master or the man, shouted wildly behind me. What cared I for his shouts? I touched the horse with my spurs and he bounded forward with such a spring that only a rider like myself could have sat him. I gave him his head and let him go. It did not matter to me where, so long as we left this inn far behind us. He thundered away across the vineyards, and in a very few minutes I had placed miles between myself and my pursuers. They could no longer tell in that wild country in which direction I had gone. I knew that I was safe. And so, riding to the top of a small hill, I drew my pencil and notebook from my pocket, and proceeded to make plans of those camps which I could see, and to draw the outline of the country. He was a dear creature upon whom I sat, but it was not easy to draw upon his back, for every now and then his two ears would cock, and he would start, and quiver with impatience. At first I could not understand this trick of his, but soon I observed that he only did it when a peculiar noise, yoy, 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 came from somewhere among the oak woods beneath us. And then suddenly this strange cry changed into a most terrible screaming, with the frantic blowing of a horn. Instantly he went mad, this horse. His eyes blazed. His mane bristled. He bounded from the earth and bounded again, twisting and turning in a frenzy. My pencil flew one way and my notebook another. And then, as I looked down into the valley, an extraordinary sight met my eyes. The hunt was streaming down it. The fox I could not see, but the dogs were in full cry, their noses down, their tails up, so close together that they might have been one great yellow and white moving carpet. And behind them rode the horsemen. My faith, what a sight! Consider every type which a great army could show. Some in hunting dress, but the most in uniforms. Blue dragoons, red trousered hussars, green riflemen, artillerymen, gold slashed lancers, and most of all red, for the infantry officers ride as hard as the cavalry. Such a crowd, some well mounted, some ill, but all flying along as best they might, the subaltern as good as the general, jostling, and pushing, spurring, and driving, with every thought thrown to the winds, save that they should have the blood of this absurd fox. Truly, they are an extraordinary people, the English. But I had little time to watch the hunt, or to marvel at these islanders, for of all these mad creatures the very horse upon which I sat was the maddest. You understand that he was himself a hunter, and that the crying of these dogs was to him what the call of a cavalry trumpet in the street yonder would be to me. It thrilled him. It drove him wild. Again and again he bounded into the air, and then, seizing the bit between his teeth, he plunged down the slope and galloped after the dogs. I swore, and tugged, and pulled, but I was powerless. This English general rode his horse with a snaffle only, and the beast had a mouth of iron. It was useless to pull him back. One might as well try to keep a grenadier from a wine bottle. I gave it up in despair, and, settling down in the saddle, I prepared for the worst which could befall. What a creature he was! Never have I felt such a horse between my knees. His great haunches gathered under him with every stride, and he shot forward ever faster and faster, stretched like a greyhound, while the wind beat in my face and whistled past my ears. I was wearing our undress jacket, a uniform simple and dark in itself, though some figures give distinction to any uniform, and I had taken the precaution to remove the long panache from my busby. The result was that, amidst the mixture of costumes in the hunt, there was no reason why mine should attract attention, or why these men, whose thoughts were all with the chase, should give any heed to me. The idea that a French officer might be riding with them was too absurd to enter their minds. I laughed as I rode, for, indeed, amid all the danger, there was something of comic in the situation. I have said that the hunters were very unequally mounted, and so at the end of a few miles, instead of being one body of men, like a charging regiment, they were scattered over a considerable space, the better riders well up to the dogs, and the others trailing away behind. Now, I was as good a rider as any, and my horse was the best of them all, and so you can imagine that it was not long before he carried me to the front. And when I saw the dogs streaming over the open, and the red-coated huntsman behind them, and only 7 or 8 horsemen between us, then it was that the strangest thing of all happened, for I too went mad, I, Etienne Gerard. In a moment it came upon me, this spirit of sport, this desire to excel, this hatred of the fox. Accursed animal, should he then defy us? Vile robber, his hour was come. Ah, it is a great feeling, this feeling of sport, my friends, this desire to trample the fox under the hoofs of your horse. I have made the fox chase with the English. I have also, as I may tell you someday, fought the box fight with the Bustler, of Bristol. And I say to you, that this sport is a wonderful thing, full of interest as well as madness. The farther we went, the faster galloped my horse, and soon there were but 3 men, as near the dogs as I was. All thought of fear of discovery had vanished. My brain throbbed, my blood ran hot, only one thing upon earth seemed worth living for, and that was to overtake this infernal fox. I passed one of the horsemen, a hussar like myself. There were only 2 in front of me now. The one in a black coat, the other the blue artilleryman whom I had seen at the inn. His gray whiskers streamed in the wind, but he rode magnificently. For a mile or more we kept in this order, and then, as we galloped up a steep slope, my lighter weight brought me to the front. I passed them both, and when I reached the crown I was riding level with the little, hard-faced English huntsman. In front of us were the dogs, and then, 100 paces beyond them, was a brown wisp of a thing, the fox itself, stretched to the uttermost. The sight of him fired my blood. Ha, we have you then, assassin! I cried, and shouted my encouragement to the huntsman. I waved my hand to show him that there was one upon whom he could rely. And now there were only the dogs between me and my prey. These dogs, whose duty it is to point out the game, were now rather a hindrance than a help to us, for it was hard to know how to pass them. The huntsman felt the difficulty as much as I, for he rode behind them, and could make no progress toward the fox. He was a swift rider, but wanting in enterprise. For my part, I felt that it would be unworthy of the hussars of Conflans if I could not overcome such a difficulty as this. Was Etienne Gerard to be stopped by a herd of fox dogs? It was absurd. I gave a shout, and spurred my horse. "Hold hard, sir! Hold hard!" cried the huntsman. He was uneasy for me, this good old man, but I reassured him by a wave and a smile. The dogs opened in front of me. 1 or 2 may have been hurt, but what would you have? The egg must be broken for the omelette. I could hear the huntsman shouting his congratulations behind me. 1 more effort, and the dogs were all behind me. Only the fox was in front. Ah, the joy and pride of that moment! To know that I had beaten the English at their own sport. Here were 300, all thirsting for the life of this animal, and yet it was I who was about to take it. I thought of my comrades of the Light Cavalry Brigade, of my mother, of the Emperor, of France. I had brought honor to each and all. Every instant brought me nearer to the fox. The moment for action had arrived, so I unsheathed my saber. I waved it in the air, and the brave English all shouted behind me, Only then did I understand how difficult is this fox chase, for one may cut again and again at the creature, and never strike him once. He is small, and turns quickly from a blow. At every cut I heard those shouts of encouragement from behind me, and they spurred me to yet another effort. And then at last the supreme moment of my triumph arrived. In the very act of turning I caught him fair with such another backhanded cut as that with which I killed the aide-de-camp of the Emperor of Russia. He flew into two pieces, his head one way and his tail another. I looked back, and waved the blood-stained saber in the air. For the moment I was exalted, superb. Ah, how I should have loved to have waited to have received the congratulations of these generous enemies. There were 50 of them in sight, and not one who was not waving his hand and shouting. They are not really such a phlegmatic race, the English. A gallant deed in war or in sport will always warm their hearts. As to the old huntsman, he was the nearest to me, and I could see with my own eyes how overcome he was by what he had seen. He was like a man paralyzed, his mouth open, his hand, with outspread fingers, raised in the air. For a moment my inclination was to return, and to embrace him. But already the call of duty was sounding in my ears, and these English, in spite of all the fraternity which exists among sportsmen, would certainly have made me prisoner. There was no hope for my mission now, and I had done all that I could do. I could see the lines of Massena's camp no very great distance off, for, by a lucky chance, the chase had taken us in that direction. I turned from the dead fox, saluted with my saber, and galloped away. But they would not leave me so easily, these gallant huntsmen. I was the fox now, and the chase swept bravely over the plain. It was only at the moment, when I started for the camp, that they could have known that I was a Frenchman, and now the whole swarm of them were at my heels. We were within gunshot of our pickets, before they would halt, and then they stood in knots, and would not go away, but shouted and waved their hands at me. No, I will not think that it was in enmity. Rather would I fancy that a glow of admiration filled their breasts, and that their one desire was to embrace the stranger who had carried himself so gallantly and well. Gutenberg edition. End of chapter.